PR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. What makes you laugh at the movies? The Pink Panther? Slapstick? Spoofs? Screwballs? Romantic comedy? Film scholar Greg Rickman joins us today to talk about Hollywood's comedies. Rickman is the editor of the Film Comedy Reader. He has also contributed 4 essays for the collection. In all, the Reader contains more than 40 pieces on the genre. The essays in the collection come close to spanning a century of movie comedy. The earliest, about Harold Lloyd, was written by Luella Parsons in 1919. Listeners, I hope you'll join the discussion with your questions and comments. What are your favorite film comedies? Why? You can also share your picks and pans if you've seen something recently that you'd like to talk about. Join us with the telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. We last spoke with Greg in July about science fiction in movies, as he is also the editor of the Science Fiction Reader. Greg Rickman has taught at San Francisco and Sonoma State Universities and at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's authored 2 books of interviews and a biography of Philip Dick. His essays and reviews have appeared in several publications, including Film Quarterly and Film Facts. The Film Comedy Reader is published by Limelight Editions. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Greg, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Hello, and thank you. Good afternoon.
Do you recall seeing your first movie comedy? On television or at the movies? On television or at the movies?
It was the Marx Brothers that made me a film fan.
Yeah.
When I was like 12 or 13, you know, up to that point I'd seen basically like sitcoms and such like. But when I saw The Good Old Stuff on one of the local channels, back when local channels ran old movies, it was just a revelation to me. And yeah. Before long I was interested in seeing comedies of all sorts, from all times.
Yeah, yeah. Seeing a triple bill of Marx Brothers films at the movies when I was a youngster, I had one of the best times of my life on the big screen. They came to a revival house, and oh, fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. There's madness there. There's anarchy. And yet there's also innocence there. I mean, we have Harpo, after all.
That's right. That's right. That's why they're such a great team, because they incarnate so many different aspects of human nature. I guess you could call Groucho would be the hyper-intelligent superego, and Chico would be an id figure. Harpo would be... I'm losing track of my Freudian terms. But between the three of them, they run the gamut.
Yeah, yeah. In your introduction to this this reader, the Film Comedy Reader, one of the interesting things you observe is this. While we associate comedy with the act of laughter, there's more here. Often there's more. You quote a film scholar by the name of Paul Grave, who said that the equation of comedy with laughter is, in his words, an almost universal mistake. And he likens comedy to a celebration of life.
Much comedy is.
Yeah, yeah.
Much comedy is. I think the best comedy is.
Yeah. And
but,
on
the other hand, a good deal of comedy can be very bitter and angry and pointed and directed against social problems or and even more negatively, other people. So there's definitely many different uses you can put comedy to, not all of them positive.
Yeah. I suspect that that insight, the Italian comedy star and director Roberto Benigni would agree with. And,
oh, yes.
You know, that idea comes through loud and clear within the fable that he made, Life is Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. That's quite so. That's quite so. It was a interesting leap for him, but in fact he had already made comedies about serial killers, and so he'd already been using the horrible as a way of bouncing off his rather, openly silly form of humor.
Yeah. Well, is there a link between comedy and the creepy?
Some of the more successful horror films have incorporated over the last 10 or 20 years utilized what the filmmaker Sam Raimi, now best known for his Superman films, but back in the 80s with his Evil Dead films, he called Splatstick. It was this mix of the grotesque and the funny and the horrible.
Yeah. This idea of comedy being a celebration of life,
mm-hmm.
though you wonder also in this introductory essay that you've written if it's a little old-fashioned, that view, given what you call our contemporary emphasis on carnivalesque transgression.
Yes, that was that's the view presently widely held amongst comedy intellectuals, if that's not an oxymoron, but academics who study comedy see it as a what the best comedy is a transgression against social mores, what the people should be doing. And they bring up the concept of the medieval carnival, which is celebrated by a Russian theorist named Bakhtin. And they say that is what the true comedy is. And as such, they endorse splatstick. They would endorse the comedy of the grotesque over the comedy that celebrates life, the more traditional view that Paul Grave spoke for in his humanistic comments. I personally have a soft spot in my heart for the old humanist definition. I'm old-fashioned in that way.
Yeah. How long has black comedy been with us?
In cinema, you really see it coming in the 60s. I think the major turning point, breakthrough, was Dr. Strangelove, written by the American Terry Southern and directed by the American expatriate Stanley Kubrick, but filmed in England, and as such, it's a good base for them to satirize both East and West in the Cold War.
Yeah.
So the Cold War was so horrific that it was just a wonderful basis to use as a terrible target.
In that essay, at that point when you talk about Dr. Strangelove, you quote someone who talks about being horrified at that movie in the 60s
when it came out. They thought the prospect of atomic annihilation of humanity was just too serious to be funny at all. And many people feel the same way about that even today. But the current view is that, yes, everything is subject to humor. And that is why the old concepts of humor as an enlightening humanistic practice have pretty much gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah. Are there films that have turned upside down in terms of when they were first screened, there was one reaction, and then later it looks funny to us, or it looks, when it was meant to be funny, it looks horrifying?
Well, a great example is the Buster Keaton film The General in 1926, which was widely disliked at the time for making fun of the Civil War. It's a comedy. I don't know if you might have seen it. It's probably Buster's best-known feature now, about a little man who becomes involved in a Civil War activity that is based on a true historical event. So Southern reviewers were quite upset by the film because it was mocking to them the great struggle that they had undergone in the what they call the war between the states. And Keaton was making light of it. And there's actually some bits of what we would call black humor in it, actually, people dying. And Keaton running forth to grab the flag and waving it around and then falling down. So that film was rejected by audiences and critics in 1926 when it came out. But now, in fact, it was rediscovered in the 1960s while Keaton was still alive as a brilliant comedy, a satire of war, and people have a completely different opinion of it now.
Yeah, yeah. Comedy has often been used as a way of, well, satire leaps to mind, but as a way of commenting on our situation. And I guess this gets back to that humanistic view of comedy. I mean, you think of, for example, think of Chaplin's Modern Times.
Oh, yes. Yes, Chaplin was such a great filmmaker. He was always making astute comments on contemporary society that still ring true today. I mean, you can look at Modern Times, 1936 film, in which he's satirizing the Industrial Revolution. His little tramp character is going to work on the assembly line and getting caught up in the gears and carried forth through it and spat out. And you can go back and look at his 1917 film, The Immigrant, which has Chaplin coming over from Europe and being pushed around by the equivalent of the INS at the Ellis Island depot for immigrants. And that you can use clips from that today to illustrate the debates about immigration in the U.S. now.
Yeah, yeah. How was his film that where he sent up Hitler, how was that received at the time?
Some people were shocked. Some people were appalled that he would conflate his own screen character with that of Adenoid Hinkle, with his version of Hitler. As you may recall, in the film he plays a double role. He plays a Jewish barber, and he plays the Adenoid Hinkle character, and there's a mix-up, and the barber replaces the Hinkle character on the review stand, just as Hinkle is declaring war, and he calls for peace. So the film has a very noble pacifist message that is relayed at the end. Many people loved it. Many people, even today, see Chaplin's satire of Hitler as very precise. And if you look at his gibberish speak that he gives, the funniest scenes in the film involve his satire of Hitler's ravings, and they're still very on point today. It had a mixed but generally positive reaction. I understand British audiences loved it, particularly because they were under siege in 1940 at the time. In the U.S., people who were against American intervention to help the anti-Hitler cause were much cooler toward the film.
Yeah. That makes me think of, you know, I'm thinking of Spike Lee at this moment, because
yes,
another satirist, another commentator on life, admired by some, criticized by others.
That's right. Yes, the responses to his work run the absolute range. And Lee is a very interesting filmmaker to talk about in terms of comedy, because there's this great, or should I say, a very large tradition of demeaning humor with African-American performers. And he took that head on in his film Bamboozled in 2000, and did a very scorching satire of how that material would play today and does play today. If you look at the film carefully, you see he's actually targeting a lot of black comedians now who he feels that are doing minstrel show type work. He's very explicit about that, both in the film and in his own public comments.
Yeah. Has he made any comments on Barbershop?
I don't know that he's spoken directly to Barbershop, but if you look at Bamboozled, there's a scene where his researcher is going out and collecting examples of contemporary comedy starring African-Americans that are presented as being demeaning, and very prominently displayed is Friday, a video cassette of Friday, which was a Barbershop-type ensemble comedy that Lee doesn't find appropriate. He finds minstrel show-like.
Yeah, because Barbershop was also subject to, you know, people who said good movie and people who said horrible movie. And Cedric the Entertainer, the role that he played, was seen as that kind of, you know, that kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's true. What's just to step out beyond Lee's comments on that, I think it's really nice that there is One of the thriving subgenres in comedy now, or what I guess you what is the trade calls the urban comedy, but the African American centered comedy that opens fairly large, and there's a substantial audience for these films. And I saw, for example, My Baby's Daddy earlier this year, which I didn't think was a half bad movie at all. There's a lot going on in the genre, and just like any other subgenre, you can do good work in it.
Yeah, yeah. What's that movie about?
It's about three irresponsible young men whose girlfriends have children, and they have to grow up. Two of them are African American, and one of them is Michael Imperioli from The Sopranos. And they're all buddies, and some of the girlfriends or wives-to-be are African-American, and some are white, and some are Asian. So you have a real cross-cultural mix in that particular film.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking about film comedy this afternoon with Greg Rickman. He is the editor of the Film Comedy Reader. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. The earliest film comedies, did they rely on slapstick? Were they slapstick pictures?
The earliest, very, very earliest comedy is one of the very first French little 56-second films that was made by the Lumiere brothers back in 1895. And it's a little vignette called Watering the Gardener. That's the general translation. And the gardener is out there watering the field, and a mischievous boy steps on the hose, and when the gardener looks at the blocked-up hose to see where the water went, he takes his foot off. The boy takes his foot off of the hose, and the gardener is squirted in the face. Big laugh. And then before the film ends, the gardener chases down the boy and spanks him. So already in that one little miniature film, you have a very common plot aspect of screen comedies and actually films in general, where you have order, where you have the gardener doing his job, disorder, where you have the water being blocked and the authority figure is squirted in the face, and then order restored. You have the mischievous boy being spanked. Many comedies have that pattern. Many comedies have the pattern where you have order and then you have disorder, and then the film will end chaotically, as in, for example, Dr. Strangelove with the world coming to an end. But many other comedies end with the boy and the girl who met early in the film and then had a series of disasters overtake them. Ultimately, order is restored, and you have the couple coming together and have a happy ending.
Yeah. Now, the Marx Brothers movies, they traded a lot on madness and chaos.
And disorder, absolutely.
Yeah, and anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we love that.
Yes.
And I think maybe later in their films, the later ones, they didn't succeed as much because there was too much order restored.
Very well said. Well, at the time, it's very interesting. The films they did in the early 1930s, which are very chaotic and anarchic, they were quite popular. Films such as Animal Crackers and Monkey Business and Horse Feathers, where they disrupt the university. And then in 1933, they did what many people now consider their greatest film, Duck Soup, where they mock war and they mock government. But just at that time, the New Deal was coming to power, and there was a shift that maybe government can help us after all. So the film wasn't very popular. And they migrated from Paramount, which had been the home to their earlier chaotic comedies, to MGM, the most conservative of the major Hollywood studios. And the producer there, Irving Thalberg, gave them a makeover where the anarchic characters become subordinate to the well-regulated plot, where you have comedy scenes interrupted with romantic scenes with the boy and girl lovers, and then you have musical numbers. A Night at the Opera and The Day at the Races, which they did at MGM, have many hilarious sequences in them and are still good comedies to watch, but you have the Marxist subordinate to this order restored sort of plot where they're helping out the young lovers. And their later MGM films are even more along those lines. So what we love today now are those early Paramount comedies, and then The Night at the Opera, which is certainly an extremely well-made film.
Yeah, yeah. One of the worst Marx Brothers films, and this is hard to say a Marx Brothers film is bad, but the Big Store.
Oh, my God, yes.
Oh.
That's the last of the film they did at MGM. Thalberg had been dead for many years by that point, and it was being manufactured by pretty much hacks. They're filling out their contract. It's sad to watch. They have, instead of disrupting a government or a university, they're disrupting, but not really disrupting, a department store. So you have these scenes where they're popping in and out of bureaus, and there's not much in the way of satire of capitalism in that particular film.
No.
It's just weak.
It's a groaner. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line one in Homer. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. I wanted to put in a vote for a couple of my favorite exemplars of dark humor, and that's the Coen brothers and Tim Burton. And I think the Coen brothers' dark humor is an intrinsic part of their style.
That's quite so.
Yeah.
Yes, that's quite so. The Coen brothers are cool because they will do really silly stuff, as in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Or The Big Lebowski, but they'll also do some out-and-out, just really dark, dark comedy. In fact, I think their best film is Miller's Crossing, which is actually a gangster film, but it has some really hilarious things in it. So they do that mix of seriousness and humor that makes their films work really well. And Tim Burton, I particularly like that early Pee Wee Herman film he did, Pee Wee's Big Adventure, which is one of the best comedies of the 1980s.
I think, however, with Tim Burton, his going over the top with the darkness of his humor sometimes harmed at least the box office of his movies. I'm thinking particularly of Mars Attacks, which I thought was hilarious, but I think he just went too far over the top with the darkness and the grossness of some of the scenes. But his last film, Big Fish, I thought was wonderful. I thought he moderated his usual intentions, and I thought it worked really well.
I think you hit the nail exactly on the head. Mars Attacks was really just too silly and too dark. And Big Fish, works very well as a film that reaffirms positive values, and audiences warmed to that and responded to that. At the same time, it still has Burton's imagination expressed in the carnival sequences, for example.
Exactly. I also want to put in a vote for Peter Berg as well. I can't remember the title of his initial directorial effort, and his TV show that didn't last long also had a dark thread running through it, which also probably contributed to its early cancellation. But Peter Berg is a sensibility, I think, similar to both the Coens and to Tim Burton.
Okay.
Would you agree?
I wish you. What was the film that he did? Because I don't play them.
I'm trying to remember. It was about a bachelor party in Las Vegas. A group of guys. And,
oh yes.
Jeremy Piven's character accidentally kills a prostitute.
Yeah,
and
I remember that. Oh yes.
I just can't recall the title.
I recall the film. Cameron Diaz was in it. I'm sure some listener will remember it or check it out. Oh yeah, that is very definitely a black comedy. So.
Yeah, I think he shares a very similar sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's all I had to say.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Greg Rickman, editor of the Film Comedy Reader, and film comedy, our topic this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. I really admire the Coen brothers. I think they are fine filmmakers.
Absolutely.
Boy, The Big Lebowski, Fargo, they're dark comedies, but they are wonderful.
The Big Lebowski has an enormous cult following. They just had a Big Lebowski convention in New York City not too long ago. It has like this, the film wasn't that successful when it came out. It came out after Fargo, which had been their big hit. And people were expecting, of course, more of the same. But The Big Lebowski, with his really laid-back character, marvelously incarnated by Jeff Bridges, developed a real cult word of mouth following, and it's just gotten bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and those fantasy scenes are fabulous.
They are.
The bowling.
the parody of the Busby Berkeley musical number, the bowling sequence.
Oh,
yes.
Those are wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes, everybody loves the dude. The real dude the character's based on is a guy named Jeff Dowd, as I understand it, who's Glory's in the film, and has recently been popping up in the news, doing some political campaigning, I believe, if you can believe it.
Yeah. The Coen brothers, I think they're fans of anarchy, aren't they?
Yes. Yes, I'd say so. I'd say so. Their more recent films have been less successful, I think, than their best of their 90s films. I don't know if you saw their remake of the English comedy, The Lady Killers. It came out earlier this year.
No, I heard it was awful, but...
I wouldn't say it was awful. It just was unnecessary. I think that's a good way of putting it. There's some really funny stuff in it, particularly Tom Hanks, who is absolutely hilarious in the role of this decayed Southern colonel. But if you go back and look at the marvelous British comedy from 1955, you have a very droll, beautifully worked out narrative, and like it works like clockwork. And then the Coen brothers' style is kind of like molasses in the clockwork in that particular remake.
Yeah, I think Elvis Mitchell said something like, don't leave the house to see this movie until you've read The Cereal Box, The Phone Book... Something like that. Something like that. That was the spirit behind it. It was just like, if you've got anything to do, do it.
Yes. Everybody goes through slack periods, even our finest. You already mentioned the Marx Brothers, and the Coen Brothers have had their share of duds, too. Maybe they're going through a fallow period now.
Yeah.
But I have faith that they'll perk up and deliver something marvelous down the line.
Yeah. Woody Allen has had his ups and downs.
Oh, yes. Yes, and over his long career, he's had more hits than misses. Again, most people think that he's in a real fallow period right now. Most people haven't liked anything he's done since the late 90s, which doesn't seem too long ago, but since he turns out a film a year, it's added up quite a bit. If you look at something like The Curse of the Jade Scorpion, you kind of scratch your head and say, why was this made? But actually, if you go back and look over Allen's filmography, he was turning out duds in the 70s and 80s sometimes, too. I appreciate his work ethic. I recently saw an interview with him where he was commenting on the bad press his recent work has gotten, and he said, well, what do people want me to do? I just want to work. So he just sits down and works, writes out a script, puts it out, and he's in his late 60s now, and he's not going to stop. So I just have to take my hat off to that way that he just keeps going.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I admire about the films that he's made that I admire, their intelligence.
Yes.
And his attention to language.
Mm-hmm.
He's a filmmaker who loves words.
That's right. That's right. And, if you've read his New Yorker essay, some of the comedy essays that he's written, he's just really marvelous at running riffs. You may have read the short story he did where... the characters from Gustave Flaubert's Madame Bovary start turning up in contemporary Manhattan, and the way that the characters are actually falling into the book is just really nice. So yes, he loves words, he loves language, which of course makes his films richer, and pays off in how many films in which Allen plays a writer of some sort, a novelist or a gag writer or a comedian or a playwright. This comes up again and again in his work.
Yeah. Well, another filmmaker who loved words, Billy Wilder.
Oh, yes.
And you've got an essay in this collection about him, and
that's
Some
right.
Like It Hot.
Yes, Some Like It Hot is many people's choice for the greatest comedy of all time. It's certainly one of the greatest comedies of all time. It's a film in which Wilder revels in American vernacular, the slang of the 1920s, when in fact Wilder... at the time was actually living in Germany, and he came over to the U.S. In the mid-30s, and he learned how to speak English and write in English by just incessantly listening to the radio and to movies and reading comic strips. He just kind of saturated himself in American popular culture of the 20s and 30s, and that comes across, his knowledge of that comes across in Some Like It Hot.
Yeah, it's interesting you point out that he was a real stickler. He wanted his actors... to say the words that he had on the page.
That's right. He was not one of those directors who allowed improvisation at all. He had his actors read every word exactly as he and his co-screenwriter wrote them, and he would insist on multiple takes and, you know, 50 takes if necessary to get the words out precisely correctly, because he loved the language so much and he had devoted so much effort to crafting the words the actors were going to speak.
Yeah. What does it do to the actors to have to go through a scene that is supposed to be funny 50 times? I imagine it doesn't feel so funny.
It's hard on them. Jimmy Cagney retired from films for 20 years after making 1, 2, 3 with Wilder in 1961, where he had Wilder had Cagney repeat a certain scene many, many times. There's a scene where he's putting on a tux, or he's rattling off. He has the Horst Buchholz character is being dressed up by him. And so he's ordering up clothes for him, and he has to order, you know, precise. He lists off, rattles off a bunch of shirts and tuxes and so forth. And Cagney had to say every word exactly properly in the sequence. And then, of course, Cagney, wonderful actor, had done some of his best work going back to the early 30s, where he would riff on the material that the hack screenwriters at Warner's gave to him, and he would build up those scenes into something special by improvising on them. But that wouldn't work with Wilder. So it was a real clash of wills there. And Cagney took the opportunity to step away from the screen for 20 years.
Yeah. Are there other filmmakers, or have there been other filmmakers as insistent as Wilder about language? And I wonder, you know, how does Woody Allen work with his actors in this regard? Because language is very important to him.
I believe, from what I've read about Allen as a director, he has them speak the lines, but he gives them a lot of leeway in terms of performance. Wilder would direct every detail of the performance as well, in terms of the gestures and how much to give emphasis to a word and this sort of thing. But Allen is really laid back, and people who've worked with him say he gives almost no direction at all, and some of the times they're frustrated because they want to know how they're doing. And they'll come to him after a few days of shooting, and they'll say, oh, you're doing fine. You know, if I had anything to say, I would have said it. So he's kind of gives them a great deal of hands-off freedom in terms of their performances.
Yeah. Were the Marx Brothers in Hollywood, in film, were they making it up as they went along at times? Or
at times. They certainly gave that impression.
Yeah.
Famously, back on Broadway in the 20s, the playwright George Kaufman, who had written their first big hit, The Coconuts, showed up at a performance some months into its run, and supposedly said, hey, I just heard one of my lines of dialogue. And, you know, he was quite impressed by that. And they carried that forth into their films. Their first two films, Coconuts and Animal Crackers, were film versions of the plays that they'd done on Broadway. So they knew the material cold, and they knew from their improvisations what would work. Later on, they would take out their scripts on tour, and they would perform them before live audiences, and they'd try different variations on lines to see which worked, which got the biggest laugh. And the story goes, I believe, when they were rehearsing the scene in Day at the Races, where he is playing a fake surgeon who is going to perform an operation, and he's going to wash his hands before the operation, and so he's going to take off his watch. But the villain is in the room with him, so he leaves the watch on, and he says something to the effect, I'd rather have it rusty than stolen. And in the rehearsals, Groucho tried all sorts of possible variations on the word stolen. I'd rather have it rusty than missing. I'd rather have it rusty than absent. I'd rather have it rusty than gone, until he came up with the word that got the biggest laugh. And that's the one they used in the movie.
Kaufman, yeah, I guess he was fairly out of his mind working with those folks on stage.
He could be, they could be very frustrating. they were just would often disappear from the stage, and they had to be rounded up. Chico was always going off to gamble, and in particular, and he would definitely be disappearing. So they would assign people to watch each brother, or they would. There's a still where the director has placed the Marx Brothers in a jail, one cell for each. that's picking up on that.
Kaufman is waxing Roth. So
you must come over and wax me sometime.
Yes, exactly. Greg Rickman, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, talking about film comedy. Listeners, we invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. What are your favorite film comedies? Share your picks and pans. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Jerry Lewis, let's talk about him for a while.
Sure.
He's an interesting guy. I'm not a fan of his silly movies, but he made two films that I am very fond of, The King of Comedy and Funny Bones.
Oh, and those are acting performances,
right? Yes.
He'd been on the stage, of course, since he was a kid, and he can act. He can play any role. I think he could have had a much bigger career than he actually did, although, of course, as a star, he was huge in the 50s and 60s. If he had acted or had more opportunities to act different material than the very broad, childlike slapstick type comedy mm-hmm. that he liked to do, and that had him such a big star. But yes, he's very good in Funny Bones, and he's very good in The King of Comedy.
Yeah. Boy, and if, listeners, if you haven't seen Funny Bones, I really recommend it. It's a wonderful movie. It's very dear.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it uses the British music hall tradition, which is the as its basis, which is, of course, the equivalent of American vaudeville, out of which so many great American comedians came from.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jerry Lewis is loved in France. The film Comedy Reader concentrates on Hollywood films.
That's right.
But what kinds of comedies have gone over well here in the United States that were made abroad?
Well, and back in the silent days, one of the biggest stars in the first couple of decades of the 20th century was a French comedian named Max Linder, who was a dapper gentleman in a top hat and a tux and a mustache, and he would involve in various slapstick mishaps. And he was pretty big. He was actually a big influence on Chaplin, who also had a mustache and would occasionally dress up and play the dude. Then we move into the sound era and sort of Hollywood triumphing over the entire world and sending off its products internationally. But in the post-war era, you have the marvelous Jacques Tati reaching some popularity in the U.S. With his comedies that basically brought back the art of silent comedy with
Mr. Hulot.
Mr. Hulot's Holiday yeah. and Mon Uncle. Those are actually pretty popular in the U.S., which you can certainly understand if you see them. And then you have other comedies as well down to the present day. You already mentioned Roberto Benigni. He's definitely a comic star in the mode of a silent comedy star with his exaggerated features and his wild slapstick juggling that he does. People tend to forget, but he won the best Oscar for actor when Life is Beautiful came out. He's definitely reached a huge audience with that film and some of his other films.
Yeah. Are there films, foreign films, that he, well, he's an Italian director star, but are there films, number one, that you would say we should look for that he has made? And are there other foreign comedy films that you would say, here's something, if you're looking for something to check out, definitely look for these?
Well, The Monster, which is his serial killer movie I mentioned earlier, is actually pretty funny, and I'd recommend that. And he did another film called Johnny Toothpick that is worth looking at as well, if you're talking about Benigni. And there's some really funny stuff. There's a very talented Japanese star director named Takashi Kitano. Beat Takashi, as he's known, and some of you might possibly seen in the audience have seen Zatoichi, his recent Blind Swordsman movie, which of course is a genre film, a different genre than comedy, but has a good deal of humor in it. And if you go back and look at some of his other films, such as his gangster film Sonatine, there's some really hilarious bits and pieces mixed in with the gangster material of those films. He is a director who knows how to place a camera to get a maximum effect out of a sight gag. And I was doing homework for this assignment, being on the radio, and I went out and saw a couple of comedies yesterday which I hadn't seen. And I was very impressed by the New Jersey comedy, not a foreign comedy, but the New Jersey-based comedy, Garden State.
Garden State.
Yes. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen it, but it's on my list.
You should check it out because Zach Proff knows how to place the camera for good effect. A lot of the humor in the film comes from where the camera's placed or in terms of setting off a sight gag. So I was impressed by the look of the film. And that's what important. That's what really makes help comedies translate internationally, be it Beat Takashi or Jacques Tati or Benigni or Zach Braff or, of course, the great silent comedians. Knowing how to use the cinema effectively to deliver a humorous situation.
Yeah.
To make it work for an audience. And you started off playing a Pink Panther theme. That's a great example of a long-running series where the director of most of that series, Blake Edwards, had studied the silent comedies and knew how to place the camera and knew how to effectively relate the slapstick to viewers.
Yeah. And also, to these people that we've been talking about, costume is important.
Mm-hmm. Chaplin with his uniform, his costume, the little tramp.
Mm-hmm.
Buster Keaton with his flat hat.
Mm-hmm.
The Marx Brothers with their painted-on grease paint mustache and Groucho's case, or the red curly wig that Harpo wore, or the little pinhead hat that Chico wore, and down to the present day.
Yeah, Elvis Singer's rumpled look.
Mm-hmm.
The Pink Panther, his his silly hat and his raincoat.
That's right.
Turned up. Mm-hmm. And back to Billy Wilder, his wonderful characters.
Oh, yes. And he would use costuming as another aspect to quickly define them. Of course, Some Like It Hot is built around cross-dressing, so you have the rather amusing flapper outfits that Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon wear
in
that particular film. Which, is part of a great deal of the humor of the film.
Yeah. What else did you see besides Garden State?
The other film movie I saw, I rented 13 Going on 30, which is a romantic comedy from earlier this year that I had missed. And I have to say I did not like it at all. It was a sort of a weak reworking of Big. So it was kind of a movie to tell career women to go back and act childishly as possible.
Mm.
Childhood is a wonderful state, and there's certainly many great comedies, including the Marx Brothers, that evoke that spirit of childlike play. But in this particular film, it was kind of grim to watch. But Garden State, there's a film I would recommend.
Yeah, well, there's a film out now, speaking of childlike, it's supposed to be not very good, and that's Super Babies. Baby Geniuses.
Babies, Super Baby Babies. Geniuses.
Yeah.
And this is Baby Geniuses Super Babies 2. Who knows, there'll be a Super Babies 3 or 4. But the director, is, I believe, at least of the first Super Babies movie, is Bob Clark, who did a Christmas Story back in the 80s, which, of course, is a really, really good movie. If you remember that film about the family celebration of Christmas. Based on Gene Shepard's
radio
play.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just a marvelous little film.
Oh, it's
a real sleeper
classic film. Yeah, WGN-TV often shows it around the clock.
As well they should.
On Christmas Day.
That's right. So Bob Clark is talented, but, you know, like a lot of people, I'm sure he's just looking for work, trying to get work. There's a lot of bad movies that can get financed, and it's harder to get good work done. I'm sure he only got to do A Christmas Story, probably because he directed the first couple of Porky's movies. So you do some movies that make a lot of money, and then you get to do something good.
Yeah.
That's how it works out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there is something, going back to where we started, you know, this afternoon with, comedy as being a celebration of life. There is something wonderful in comedy that it is often playful and joyful, and we can be innocents again.
Yes.
We can also be childish.
Yes.
And we can be full of mischief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is also works on not only on screen, but in the comic pages of the newspaper.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm thinking one of my current favorites on the comics page in the newspaper is Get Fuzzy.
Oh, yes.
And that is both childish and childlike.
That's right. That's right. Because you have this marvelous character, this comic villain, who we would I would place in the same line as W.C. Fields, this kind of scoundrel, who is the, Bucky the Cat, who's egotistical and he's foolish, and he makes grandiose claims for himself. And at the same time, he, you know, he's falling short, but that doesn't stop him. And then you have the very sweet dog character. And then, of course, you have the their human companion as a straight man. So it's a really nice combination. It works out really well.
Yeah, and Boondocks is another one. I think that also is sharp in terms of it's like undergoing surgery sometimes.
Yes,
it's so incisive.
Yes,
but it also can be, you know, just wonderfully human.
That's right. That's right. He has good characters. I understand he's Aaron Magruder, the Boondocks creator, has worked up a animated series based on his comic strip, and that may be coming out next year sometime.
Oh.
So hopefully that will be a good investment. He has improved very much as a draftsman. I appreciate that he's now doing caricatures of John Kerry and George Bush,
yeah,
including them, as opposed to just having the characters watch TV.
Yeah.
And, see their little voice bubbles coming out of the TV. Mm-hmm. He's now actually using the medium of the art form of comic strips, delivering characters. There's Mutz. It would be another strip I would mention as being very strong visually. And it's a very sweet little strip about a dog and a cat. And it's the artist on that does a really nice job at using visual humor to convey a gag. And so he would be in the tradition of a silent comedy, really, even though, of course, he has his dog and cat talking.
Yeah. What the name of the strip is?
Mutz.
Mutz. Yeah, it's sweet. I love it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We got to wrap it up. We got to go. Greg, thank you for talking with us again today, and really appreciate it.
Absolutely. That
a lot
was fun.
Of fun. Okay. Take care. Greg Rickman, editor of the Film Comedy Reader. The book is published by Limelight Editions. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Pre-trade ahead of tomorrow's supply and demand, world supply and demand reports, as well as crop production reports, the featured element, position squaring ahead of those reports, the key ingredient of the day. Let's go ahead and look at the specifics. September wheat, a high on the day of 313.5, a low of 310, settling 311.5, up 2.25. December, a high of 323.5, a low of 319, settling 320.25, up 0.5. The March contract at 332.5, a low of 328.5, settling 330.25, up 0.25. May wheat, a high on the day of 336, a low of 332.5, settling 333.25, down 0.5. July, a high of 338.5, a low of 334, settling 335.5, unchanged on the day. September corn, a high of 218.25, a low of 216.75, settling 217.5, up 0.5. December, a high of 227.25, a low of 226, settling 226.5, down 0.25. March, a high of 236, a low of 234.5, settling 235.25, down 0.25. May, a high of 242, a low of 240.75, settling 241.5, down 0.25. July, a high of 247, a low of 245.75, settling 246.5, down 0.5. December corn, a high of 254.75, a low of 253.5, settling 254.25, unchanged on the day. September oats, a high of 150, a low of 150, settling at the 150 and up 6.25. And it looks to me like if I page over, yes, indeed, it did trade today. December oats, a high of 152.5, a low of 149.25, settling 150.75, up 3.25. September soybeans, a high of 588, a low of 580, settling 581 and a quarter, down a quarter. November, a high of 587 and a half, a low of 579 and a half, settling 582, down 1 and a half. January, a high of 594, a low of 586 and a half, settling 589, down 1 and a half. March, a high of 601, a low of 593 and a half, settling 596 and a half, down 3 quarters. May soybeans, a high of 606 and a half, a low of $6 and a half, settling 601 and a quarter, down 1 and 3 quarters. July, a high of 611, a low of 604 and a half, settling 605, down 2 and a half. September soybean meal, a high of 175, a low of 171.70, settling 172.20, up 30. October, a high of 171.20, a low of 168.20, settling 168.40, down 80. September soybean oil, a high of 24.75, a low of 24.50, settling 24.75, up 2. October, unchanged on the day, the high there 24.19, the low 23.91, settling 24.09. The settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and Celeste, the lean hog contracts had significant strength today.
Yeah, they sure did. A couple of them up over a dollar today, Dave. Well, let's take a look at what happened today with livestock prices, and we'll begin with feeder cattle. The high price today, 111.30, the low 110.40, the settlement 110.55, that down 30. October, 108.60, the high 107.40, the low 107.75, the settlement, that down 32.5. November, 107.80, the high 106.90, the low, the settlement 107.12.5, that down 32.5. Live October cattle, October live cattle, 83.35 today's high, 82.50 the low, 82.60 the settlement, that down 30. December live cattle, 86.75 the high, 85.85 the low, 86.47.5 the settlement, that up 10 cents. October lean hogs, today's high, 66.52.5, the low, 64.40, the settlement, 65.60, that up $1.05. December lean hogs, 63.72.5, the high, the low, 62.05, the settlement, 63.65, that up 1.65. February lean hogs, 62.65, the high, 61.50, the low, 62.40, the settlement, that up 97.5. April lean hogs, the high today, 61.25, the low 60.50, the settlement 61.10, that up 52.5, and February bellies 96.20, the high 93.87.5, the low 94.17.5, the settlement, that down 187.5. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 3 points at 10,311. The NASDAQ up 24 points at 1,875. The S&P 500 5 higher at 1,121.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you.